Welcome to the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week, where every Saturday we discuss the biggest news stories of the week with Portland's noisiest newsmakers, savviest culturistas, and some of the best journalists in the game. I'm your host, Brianna Wheeler, and I want to hear from you. So send your questions and comments to me, bwheeler@wweek.com. All right, y'all, enjoy the show. For the first time in nearly 40 years, a Republican might become Oregon's governor. I know, young radicals, just breathe through it. It is okay to feel nervous. Portland is a weird liberal city, and it has been for as long as a lot of us have been alive. Rural counties are often quite conservative, and I think we all know that it makes for an uncomfortable dichotomy. For a generation, Portland's densely populated, liberal voting majority has kept the whole state blue, which makes it particularly exceptional that for the first time in such a long time, Oregon might start seeing red. I'm not nervous. Why would I be nervous? You're nervous. I'm not nervous. It's Saturday, October 8th, and this is episode 92 of The Dive. Christine Drazen, the Republican candidate for governor, has made major waves in Salem as the House Minority Leader, where her obstructionist MO has earned her a reputation as both necessarily bold and unnecessarily confrontational, depending on who you ask. Today my guest is Connor Radnovich, whose cover piece for this week's paper is a super comprehensive profile of Drazen. Connor and I will discuss what it is about Christine that has so many people thinking that this might be the year that Portland gets theoretically painted red. But first, here's what I learned from this week's edition of Willamette Week. A jury awarded more than $40,000 in damages to a woman who was beaten by Portland police officers during a 2020 protest. Sound familiar? Officers struck Erin Wenzel and threw her to the ground, breaking both of her arms. Wenzel was at the protest as a medic. This sets a necessary precedent for accountability, and it could help other protesters in their cases against the city. Nigel Jaquist reports that a complaint filed by former state rep Diego Hernandez against Democratic gubernatorial candidate and former House Speaker Tina Kotek took more than 600 days to result in a final report, and only after the former state rep confessed to the lawyer hired by the Equity Office to investigate the claim that he had attempted suicide as a result of his experience working in legislature and his experience waiting on this report. But it's worth it to know that Hernandez resigned in 2021 after being accused of harassing multiple women. Anthony Effinger put together an explainer on ranked choice voting that breaks down how the system works. And the news office even held a mock election using the method, illustrated, for your pleasure, by the talented Mackenzie Young-Roy. The bottom line? For each candidate, we each get one vote. But that one vote can transfer to a second or a third choice if our first choice is defeated early. I have a feeling that this is going to come up on the pod again, so let's just put a pin in that for the time being and go catch up on all things Christine Drazen with our guest, Connor Radnovich. I'm reading through the piece, learning about Christine, and it seems like I'm reading a pretty straightforward political career. Close to a decade's worth of staffing at the legislature, and then she moves on to lobbying positions as a political director and then an executive director. And then she snatches a House seat for representing Canby. It just all seems very straightforward career political, like this was always going to be the path. So I'm wondering, what is it about her rise that's so meteoric?
Sure. So I 100% agree that, you know, her track up to sort of 4 years ago, when she decided to run 2018 for that House seat, was standard fare, I would say. You know, mm-hmm. she was in the legislature for 8 years as an aide, then she worked as a lobbyist for a couple of organizations. The part that's most meteoric really is since 2018. Right, when she threw her name into the hat for that seat that became vacant. She won the Republican primary by, I think, only like 10 or 11 points. So mm-hmm. There were four people in that race. So it was a comfortable victory, but it wasn't like a landslide by any means. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of a safe Republican seat, so she easily won in November. And it was from that point where the unusualness of her rise really starts. Mm-hmm. Because of that, you know, when she comes into the legislature, you know, yes, she had that, you know, 8 years of experience from a couple decades prior, but she didn't have any previous elected experience. She wasn't elected to a school board. She wasn't elected to other types of local government or county government. She came in and apparently immediately expressed interest in rising to leadership, you know, within the first couple of months when she was there. And it's, you know, I looked through the records, I talked to folks who knew the new legislative records, and it was, we could not find a recent case of a first year lawmaker rising to their leader of their caucus. Like, it's incredibly rare.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And there's some cases, you know, in the past of first term lawmakers becoming speakers of the House. Usually they have previous experience. Mm-hmm. But the fact that she was able to become leader so quickly and do it in a way that ousted someone who was supposed to have a 2-year term after just 8 months, and the fact that she did it with support of Sean Gillians, one of the most powerful lobbyists in Salem, that is the unusual nature of it, and that is the sort of surprising nature when you look at, okay, so she was in 2018 just running for this House seat in a relatively close race for a Republican primary, and 4 years later she's winning the Republican primary for governor. It's you don't see that track very often.
Can you break down what happened?
Kotek was the speaker, and she's been speaker for, you know, I think 8 years at that point. But so when Drazen became the House Republican leader, she did so by essentially a coup, right? People who you talked to described it as a coup. And typically leaders are elected to serve 2-year terms. And the previous leader, Carl Wilson, he was elected in the fall of 2018, just around the election, and he was supposed to serve until 2020, right? So it basically gives the leader an opportunity to pilot the caucus through one election cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And for the minority party in particular, the job of leader is mostly election focused,
mm-hmm.
right? Their job is to try to get more seats for their caucus to increase their power in the legislature. And she was able to get that control of her caucus, of the Republican caucus, because there was a few factors that went into this. And the context here is that they are in a super minority at this point. They only have 22 members.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can't stop any bill on the floor,
yeah.
Even tax bills, even bills that need a 3/5 majority to pass, or Democrats can pass those without any Republican support.
Mm-hmm.
They're in a very bad political position from a power perspective. Combining that position with the sort of semi-annual disgruntlement that members feel toward their own leadership,
mm-hmm.
Especially when there's a lot of freshmen who come in and thinking that they can do it much better than people who are in charge can do it. All those factors sort of played into this this position that Christine Drazen found herself in, where she, you know, had support from members of her caucus, had support from powerful members of the lobby, especially after the 2019 walkout, where Republicans in the Senate walked out, Republicans in the House didn't. There was that was the catalyst, I think, for all those factors to come together and really propel her toward in September taking over. Taking over from Carl Wilson and completing the coup.
Mm-hmm. Is this... She... I'm just wondering, like, is anybody else clocking that she's using this... I mean, it was kind of a Democratic play, right? The walkout?
It's an interesting... So Democrats and Republicans will argue with you about this till, you know, the cows come home, so to speak. In 2001, Democrats walked out in the House because Republicans were prepared to pass a resolution regarding redistricting.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a procedural change than how they normally do redistricting. Normally redistricting is done via a bill,
mm-hmm.
right? Just a normal piece of legislation that both chambers have to agree on and the governor has to sign. But because the governor was a Democrat, Republicans knew that the maps that they were going to put forward were just going to get vetoed.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, Kitzhoffer had earned his reputation of being Dr. No.
Dr. No.
Vetoing all of these pieces of legislation from the Republican legislature. And so House Democrats walked out for, I think it was just a few days, until the constitutional deadline for redistricting passed. And so then the responsibility for redistricting went to the Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Secretary of State drew the maps, and he was a Democrat. And, you know, Republicans have long argued that those maps were gerrymandered, but that sort of gets on a different track there. But that's when Democrats used it, and they don't run from that necessarily, but they do very much point out that this was for a procedural, well, there was sort of like, you know, a cheating procedural move where you pass a resolution which doesn't go to the governor's office.
Mm.
It's just a Senate or just a House document, whereas a bill would have the opportunity to be vetoed. The difference then, when the Republicans did it in 19 and 20, and then occasionally, I think once again in 21, was these were for policy bills,
mm-hmm.
right? This is walking out over policy, not over procedure or constitutional concerns. And for a long time, leaders on both sides of the chamber and in both parties had drawn sort of a red line there, right? Where we will use the walkout as a deterrent for bills that we don't like. We'll use it as a way to walk out if there's a constitutional issue or if there's some sort of procedural shenanigans that we don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea to walk out over a policy bill, even a policy that would have such, you know, wide ranging impacts as the climate change bill that they did walk out over, was seen as something that could only lead to the removal, essentially, of that policy,
mm-hmm.
or of that tactic. And, you know, lo and behold, this year on the ballot, we have a ballot measure that would penalize people who walked out. Mm-hmm. The details are a little bit fuzzy to me at the moment, but there is, if you have a certain number of unexcused absences in one session, you will be banned from running for re-election. Like, it's a very significant, change that would go into place.
Wow.
It would make the walkout much less possible for members to do. And that was the concern, that if you use walking out for policy bills,
mm-hmm.
they will take this tactic away from us, and mm-hmm. then we won't have it to use as a deterrent
yeah.
for bills that we don't like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're using it as like a nuclear option.
Very much so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For all of the reporting that you've done, not just for this story, but for the last several years, do you think that she's got those aspirations for like national politics?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, if you had asked anybody 4 years ago, do you think that Christine Drazen would try to become a senator or, you know, a congressperson or, you know, run for president? Like, I think everyone would have just laughed at you, because at that point she was just literally had just been elected into the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing how quick her rise was these last 4 years, like, I think it'd be kind of foolish to put any sort of cap on it at this point.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if she is able to become Oregon's first Republican governor in almost 40 years, that is a incredible place to jump off to whatever she would want to do next, whether that's national politics, whether that's multiple terms as a governor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she could go on a speaking tour after that and get crowds for forever.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think anything is possible if she does win.
Yeah. What was the most fascinating thing that you learned about Christine Drazen while you were reporting this piece?
Sure. So it was interesting to me how she was sort of viewed differently by her staff and by other lawmakers,
mm-hmm.
right? And her staff, not directly, like I didn't speak to like her staff members, but, you know, you talk to folks who tell stories about how she treated her staff.
Mm.
And there was, from the people, from the lawmakers I spoke to, there was this, you know, very common perception of her that she was very inclusive in her decision making, right? She would bring a lot of things to the caucus. She would try to get input from, you know, other members of leadership. She would reach out to the lobby and get their input on all sorts of decisions. But people told me that that sort of inclusive nature was also sometimes veered into the realm of indecisiveness, where some people saw her as almost incapable of making a decision on her own and needing to have that input. It's, you know, of those two kind of, I sort of view them as like two sides of the same coin, right? You're trying to be inclusive, but then if it takes you 4 hours to put out a press statement and no one's going to use that statement, right? Because stories have already gone to print.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of interesting, where people can sort of view her, maybe the same actions that she's doing can view them in just different lights. And then, you know, there's plenty of other stuff that I heard about her staff treatment as well. But, you know, I think what we saw from, and it plays into this idea that we heard from other folks, where she is just like quite ruthless when she wants to be. Mm-hmm. And this was, you know, this is a quote we have in the story where she was, you know, I think the quote was incredibly talented and ruthless, or something along those lines.
Uniquely talented and incredibly ruthless.
There it is. Yeah, and it was a good line, and I think it's very emblematic of her, because she comes across as very polite and is, you know, can be quite charming, but politically she will, you know, walk right on that line of being very almost personally attacking people, but not quite, and really taking every opportunity that she has to give her party as much power as possible, mm-hmm. right? To play her cards in a way that maximizes their potential, mm-hmm. which is not something that, you know, to the extent that she did it, that was not seen in previous leadership, right? Mm-hmm. Walking out was not something that was done regularly before she was in leadership. In the House, and there wasn't this sense of equality necessarily between Republicans and Democrats, because Republicans were in the minority. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it from a, you know, democracy standpoint of like majority rule and how that's a very critical component of how our democracy works, it wouldn't necessarily make sense for Republicans to have equal say on bills.
Yeah,
but she didn't view it that way, right? She saw her caucus's voice as equally important to Democrats, and Democrats were going to view her as equals, mm-hmm. view them as equals.
Was there anything that was left out or cut out of the piece?
It's a good question. I think some of the details around the walkout, mm-hmm. in 2020 were interesting, because it didn't inherently make sense for them to walk out in 2020. And this is in the, this is sort of alluded to in the piece, but there are a lot more details to that. So the carbon bill that the Senate walked out on in 2019, Democrats worked on it in the interim, brought it back. It's highly unusual for a big piece of legislation like that to go through a short session. Mm. But Democrats' reasoning was that, hey, we'd worked on this a bunch before. Everyone knows what this bill is. We're just going to try to get it through this session because it's really important.
Yeah.
And so they brought this big bill into the 2020 session, and right from the jump, Republicans in both chambers were like, "Hey, if you bring this in, we're going to walk out again. Like, that's we are against this policy. We showed this. We proved this last time. And it's the same policy, so we're going to do it again." Mm-hmm. And Democrats just kept going forward with it, and the bill was started in the Senate this time, and 19 started in the House. So when the Senate Republicans walked out, when the bill was about to come to the floor for a final vote, the bill was dead, right? So if the Senate Republicans never come back, then there's no chance that the bill progresses, because it is, you know, that's how the legislative process works. It has to pass out of the Senate first, and then it has to go to the House, and the House has to pass, and then it has to go to the governor's office. So there was no reason at that point, when House Republicans left the next day, for them to leave if their concern was that bill. And I take that at their word that they were concerned about that bill, but it was, it could be viewed as it was legislatively unimportant for them to walk out because they had no impact. It had no impact on that bill, which is something that I think, again, we include in the story, but it, I think it's really critical to sort of drive that home because if there wasn't a legislative reason to do it, then what was the reason to do it?
Mm-hmm.
Right. It was a political reason.
Yeah.
Right. So what House Republicans, and this was something that I did not, that we didn't include in the story, but there were a lot of rumors at the time, and I heard this again when I was reporting for the story, there was a lot of sort of almost jealousy from House Republicans towards Senate Republicans when Senate Republicans walked out in 2019. Because if you remember, they got international attention, right? They were doing interviews on Fox News from wherever they were staying in Idaho. They're doing interviews with obviously all of the Oregon folks are covering all of us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that there was a press conference where I think it was either Washington Post or Rolling Stone was like in the Oregon Capitol, like doing interviews with Republicans about this walkout. It got huge attention, and it also sparked this really, it turned out to be very important grassroots movement called Timber Unity.
Oh, yes.
Where yes, and you know, very famous now, but at the time, took everybody by surprise. Mm-hmm. You know, there was this, you know, multi-thousand person rally with tons of logging trucks and pickups and, you know, other vehicles that just drove around the Capitol and honked. The show of support was pretty incredible for Senate Republicans. And now that did not translate into electoral victories.
Yeah.
But that with the House Republicans wouldn't know that because the 2020 election hadn't happened yet. So there was a fair amount, it seemed, of you know, FOMO or jealousy from House Republicans towards Senate Republicans. So the implication is that if there wasn't a legislative reason to walk out in 2020 for House Republicans, and then the political reason would be because they wanted to get some of that, you know, grassroots support that came out in support of Senate Republicans. And so that was something that, you know, it takes a bit of a long walk to get to that point. You have to understand a lot of context around sort of the grassroots movements in Oregon.
Yeah.
But that wasn't something I think was interesting and, you know, would have been cool to include in the story, too.
Big thanks to today's guest, Connor Radnovich, and thank you for joining me. I hope you'll join me again next week. Until then, bye!